So we're just writing down some equations that are always true for general perturbation of the FRW spacetime. This first set of equations defines the general perturbation to the FRW metric as a scalar perturbation A, a three-vector Bi, and a symmetric three-tensor Hij, which are all first-order quantities in perturbation theory. And there's no physics here. This is just splitting up the general perturbation of FRW in sort of a, you know, 3 plus 1 dimensional notation. We can do an analogous thing for the stress energy tensor to define the general stress energy perturbation as a scalar delta rho, a scalar delta p, a 3-vector vi, and a traceless symmetric 3-tensor pi ij. This is traceless. And there is some physics here, because without the pi term, this stress energy tensor is just the stress energy of a perfect fluid, which would be written covariantly like this. Written out in components for this metric, and allowing the pressure and the density of the perfect fluid to be some spatial mean plus a fluctuation. Now the next thing I want to derive quickly is just how the components, and then we talked about a gauge transformation. The gauge symmetry of general relativity is just a redundancy of description. So there's a symmetry if you apply an infinitesimal coordinate transformation. Then you'll get a symmetry, a set of shifts that you apply to all the fields, which will be preserved by Einstein's equations. Let me just talk a little bit. Someone asked before class, so let me answer for everybody. The reason why you know, it's sort of useful to build gauge transformations into the formalism is that, well, first off, in this generality, where I haven't fixed the gauge, then Einstein's equations are going to be underdetermined. They're not going to fully specify the evolution of the system. That's always true if you have an unfixed gauge symmetry by the following argument. So underdetermined means that the initial conditions don't determine the behavior, the fields at later times. And if I have a gauge symmetry and I have one solution to the field equations, if I have some initial data, this direction's time. If I have initial values of the fields on some time slice, and then I have some solution to the field equations at later times, then if I apply a gauge transformation, I'll get another solution to the field equations. And in particular, I can consider a gauge transformation which is zero near the initial data, near the initial slice, and takes non-zero values out here and changes field values around. But that's another solution of the field equations with the same initial conditions but later values at later times. So it appears that I have an undetermined system of equations. Of course, all that's really happening is that we have a redundancy of description. There's different values of the fields corresponding to different coordinate systems that all describe the same physics. Now you might wonder why we don't just fix the gauge at the outset. The reason is that it turns out that in cosmology, there's no sort of super gauge that's convenient for every purpose. It's more like we have one gauge that's convenient during inflation, and another gauge maybe that's convenient for thinking about the CMB perturbations, another gauge that's more convenient for actually numerically integrating them, and another gauge that's more convenient in the late universe, and so on. So, of course, to actually get well-defined equations of motion, we'll need to fix the gauge. But it's also useful, given two prescriptions for fixing the gauge, to be able to work out how to go back and forth between the variables of one and the variables of the other. And that's why we need the formulas for the gauge transformations. All right, so the next thing I want to compute are the gauge transformations for the stress energy. I have them up here for the metric. And that's just another Lie derivative calculation. So to compute, in general, if I apply a gauge transformation epsilon, then team you knew gets a contribution equal to minus the lead derivative, and with both indices raised, that looks like this. And so just to compute one component, delta t 0,0 would be, let's see, most of the terms are zero, because I'm only computing to first order, and epsilon is a first order quantity. I can evaluate t unperturbed. So there's a term here that looks like epsilon 0 times delta 0 of rho bar. There's a term here which looks like there are two of these terms. And so I get calling epsilon 0 alpha. That's how t upper 0,0 shifts under a gauge transformation. And comparing with the expression for t 0,0 in components, which is this, and using the previously derived formula for the change in A under a gauge transformation, we get the transformation law for delta rho. The other components can be derived similarly. So I'll say similarly. The transformation law for delta p is almost the same thing, it's with a p dot instead of a rho dot. Here's the transformation law for v. These are all just worked out by computing the derivative. And the change in pi ij is zero. Pi is gauge invariant. That makes sense because we defined pi to be the quantity that was zero if the stress energy was that of a perfect fluid. And that's something that all observers will agree on. If we had taken this definition of the stress energy tensor, sort of looks ugly. It's motivated by this. But when you write it out in components, it looks ugly. And if I had chosen a less ugly representation, then I would have gotten more complicated gauge transformation laws here. Okay. One more comment on the stress energy tensor. If I have n perfect fluids, which is a pretty good description for most of the universe. Like I have one perfect fluid for the dark matter, one perfect fluid for the photons, and so on, with different dynamics. Then we parameterize, each of them has a stress energy tensor. We parameterize the jth stress energy tensor by a delta rho for j, a delta p for j, a delta vi for j. So there'll be 10n degrees of freedom for the n fluids. You anticipate that we're going to have differential equations in many variables. Just to write that out in detail, you know, what I mean by this is that I define delta rho j, say, so that T00 of the jth fluid is rho bar j times 1 minus 2a plus delta rho j. The point is that the bar also has a j on it. The rho bar also has a j on it wherever it appears. I don't use the total density of the universe here. And similarly for the other components, let me say. And this convention makes sense because I want, for example, the pi to be zero if the stress energy tensor is isotropic in the fluid rest frame, not in the rest frame of the universe. The average rest frame of all the stress energy tensors. So, you know, some quantities are gauge invariant and some are not. For example, a velocity. A bare velocity is not gauge invariant. Of course, that's because if we slightly boost the coordinate system, we get a different velocity. But just as an example of a gauge invariant quantity, if I have two species, then their relative velocity is. That makes intuitive sense, and it also follows from this transformation law. Each velocity gets the same shift under a gauge transformation, regardless of, you know, such numbers as the density of the fluid. So that if I difference them, the shift under a gauge transformation is zero. Anisotropic stress is a gauge invariant quantity. So the anisotropic stress of the jth fluid is a gauge invariant. Talked about that before, just to give sort of some intuition for what this quantity represents. Here's a question you could ask. How large, the CMB photons today form a fluid. You could ask how large this quantity pi is today. Well, to give you a way of thinking about this pi ij, the space part of the stress energy tensor is sort of what we think of as pressure. Like the trace of the space part is telling you if I have a box, if I draw a box in space, and there are CMB photons impinging on the sides of the box, then pressure is sort of the total number of photons per unit time pushing into the sides of the box. The traceless part of that tensor is keeping track of differences between the faces of the box. In other words, if the photons had some sort of net quadrupole, say, if there were more photons coming in here than here, I'll draw some short vectors to indicate that, then that would mean that we had a non-zero anisotropic stress. Now, the CMB today does have a little bit of a quadrupole. It actually, you know, has power at all values of L. Including, in particular, L equals 2. And so the quadrupole of our CMB, its moments at L equals 2, are exactly the same thing as the anisotropic stress of the photon fluid. Now, the CMB is, so the anisotropy of the CMB is giving you this. Now, the anisotropy is small. The anisotropy in the CMB is sort of 10 to the, on the order fractionally of order 10 to the minus 4. And the way the anisotropic stress is defined, just to put a number on it, it's defined with a p bar here, so that pi is dimensionless and it represents a fractional deviation from isotropy. So for the CMB today, pi ij is non-zero. Photons are not a perfect fluid, but it's small. It's of order 10 to the minus 4. The pressure and density perturbations are not gauge invariant. But if you look at how they transform, they both transform as a multiple of alpha with no beta. So there will be a linear combination, you know, even for a single fluid, which is gauge invariant. You might take it to be let's say that the equation of state of the fluid is not equal to zero, so that I can divide by both rho bar dot and p bar dot. Delta rho over rho bar dot minus delta p over p bar dot is gauge invariant. And what's happening here is that the way that we defined our stress energy tensor, the rho is just the coefficient of, the rho and the p are just coefficients of these tensors. So two different observers will agree on those, since tensors transform covariantly, two different observers will agree on those coefficients, except for the problem of time reparameterization. If I just define, you know, if I have one coordinate system and then I define a different coordinate system with different surfaces of constant time, in other words, if I turn on an alpha, the alpha is the time part of the gauge transformation, then because rho and p are changing in the background, then the two observers will interpret, you know, relative to the original coordinate system, in the new coordinate system, I interpret that the time, the change in time in the background now is a perturbation. But that's all that's happening, is that the only reason these guys aren't gauge invariant is because of time reparameterizations. And so if I sort of convert both fluctuations to units of time, if instead of the density perturbation, I consider the time that it would take for the universe to evolve to reach the same value of the density perturbation, then those times have to be the same for the pressure and the density. So there's a lot more to say. These are just to kind of get some intuition for gauge invariance and formal properties of all these definitions. There's a lot more to say, but I think just given the total amount of formalism, it's sort of more interesting to get to a physical example first. So I'm going to talk about inflation. Then maybe I'll come back. I'll talk about inflation for a while, and then I'll come back and do a little bit more formalism. Like the big thing is something called the SVT decomposition that you've probably seen, and then talk about the CMB. But first, I have to write down Einstein's equations. So these Einstein's equations, of course, are a very central, important set of equations. I'm going to show you Einstein's equations for these in these variables, defining perturbations in the metric and the stress energy tensor. But it raises a certain like lecturer's dilemma in that, in general, I like to show calculations if they sort of illustrate something new or if there's some interesting trick that comes up in the calculation that is useful to know about in other contexts. This was not one of those situations. I did go through the derivation. I felt like a little morally obligated to because I'm teaching the class. It takes maybe 10 hours, order 10 hours. If you just take this metric and stress energy tensor and compute Einstein's equation, you know, capital G mu nu equals 8 pi G T mu nu, then you have to do about 10 hours of algebra. And I can honestly say that I didn't learn anything by doing it. It was just a pure exercise in brute force algebra. And I sort of explored a little bit to see if maybe there was some, you know, conceptual way of reducing the amount of algebra that might be interesting to talk about. As far as I can tell, there wasn't anything. I had some ideas, but all of them seemed to make the amount of algebra larger, not smaller. So the lecturer's dilemma is, if I don't present anything, any derivation of Einstein's equations, then I've just let one of the most important set of equations in the class just appear out of nowhere underived. If I do derive it, then it'll just be you guys watching me do algebra, the routine algebra at the blackboard for a couple of hours, which seems kind of like a waste of everybody's time. After some soul searching, I just decided to show the result with no derivation. There's really not much to say. Everyone knows what to do, right? So the first thing that you would do, the first step in the chain, is to calculate the Christoffel symbols, you know, just this. Let's write out the steps, calculate this. Okay, so after losing only a couple of hours of your life, if you work those out in components, I got here a little earlier to start writing equations, then you get this. Don't worry, these are in a formula sheet that are on the wiki, so you don't worry about writing them down unless you want to have everything together. Okay. Then once you've done that, of course, the next step is calculating the Ricci tensor. There's some formula for that. That's really a humongous calculation. Now, maybe there is one little step here which is worth mentioning, which is that normally the way that the Einstein equation is written this way. You guys have probably seen this trick before, but just in case not, let me mention it. The combination that appears here on the left-hand side, the Ricci tensor minus 1/2 the trace of the Ricci tensor times G mu nu, is just the trace reversed Ricci tensor. I've just subtracted the multiple of the metric tensor, which makes the trace the negative what it was before. Now, trace reversing a tensor is something that if I do twice, I get back to the original tensor. So I could just as well, instead of setting the trace reversed Ricci tensor equal to the stress energy tensor, I could just as well say that Einstein's equation is R mu nu equals 8 pi g t mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu t. The first equation I think is more aesthetically appealing as a law of gravity, because I just have a quantity on the left-hand side, which is purely a function of the metric, and a quantity on the right-hand side, which is purely function of the matter, the stress energy of the matter. And here the right-hand side mixes g's and t's. But what will usually happen in the, so this is less aesthetically appealing, but what usually happens in calculations is that when you calculate r mu nu, you get a huge mess, something with lots of terms. Whereas t mu nu is simple. If the next step is trace reversing, you kind of double the size of the mess, which is annoying. You get like twice as many terms. So for calculational purposes, it's often easier to think of this as like the Einstein equation. Okay, so that's one trick that's worth mentioning. So if you do that calculation, then you get these monsters. So So these are the general form of Einstein's equations in the perturbed FRW metric. The last one, this was the simplest way that I could write them, the fewest terms after a little bit of experimentation. The notation I used in the last one, by the way, is a little non-standard. This I found it useful to define this tensor Lij. This combination that appears on the left-hand side is taking the non-symmetric tensor Lij and just projecting out the traceless symmetric part. So the first two terms are symmetrizing. And then the last term, oh, this shouldn't be delta ij, this should be, oh no, I'm sorry, delta ij is fine. And then this last term is now projecting out the trace. If I trace what's on the left-hand side, I'll get zero. And there's a traceless tensor on the right-hand side. We define pi to be traceless. This is really the traceless part of an equation that became simpler when I separated into its trace and traceless components. The other half of the equation is this, the trace part of the equation is this one, I believe. Anyway, there they are. This problem of deciding how much calculational detail to include is kind of general. There are a lot of long-ish calculations coming up. And so I'm going to try to strike a balance between like showing too much detail and making this just kind of an algebra performance, and showing too little detail and like sweeping stuff under the rug. But if I get the wrong balance, then just feel free to give me some feedback. The subject is kind of messy. As you can see, we're building up a lot of messy-looking equations. One thing that I try to... In general, you know, I like pretty physics more than messy physics. But the reason that I like this anyway, even though it's messy, is that it all really is stuff that you can measure. In fact, that even the fact that it's all measurable, at least for me, helps and even makes the messiness more interesting. Because all of the predictions that we'll get, like from integrating these equations, you know, will make this incredibly specific prediction for the CMB power spectrum. And that prediction, in fact, was made like way before the experiments were made, were done, which is totally confirmed by experiment. I mean, it's a really like, it's kind of an amazing thing in physics that you can do this incredibly complicated GR calculation with like all these extra degrees of freedom that aren't in Newtonian gravity, and predict something so precisely. Prediction is so precise because the fluctuations are small, and so linear perturbation theory applies. Like, there's no problem from theory predicting the shape of the CMB power spectrum to better than a percent. And it's measured to better than a percent. The total, if you want the total statistical significance of the measurement, is something like 1,000 sigma. So this all really is, at the end of the day, a ton of messy physics goes into it, and the beautiful agreement between theory and experiment is really amazing, especially the fact that it tests GR so well. Okay, so now we have the basic tools to this basic set of equations to start evolving perturbations in different parts of the universe. I'm going to start with inflation. Let me do a little blackboard rearranging. Okay, so I'm going to talk about inflation, but first, my favorite daily ritual is GR quiz time. So, here are some integrals. Some of which have the square root minus g, and some of which don't, and some of which have a covariant derivative and others don't. So which of these integrals are always zero in GR? What is x? Just integration over space-time. Oh, X mu is a vector field. So X mu could be any quantity that. I mean, some of these aren't covariant, but let's just say that you took the components of a vector field in some coordinate system, applied ordinary non-covariant partial derivatives, and integrated.
Depending on
that's
been the case at the boundary and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, right. There would, in general, be a boundary term, right? That is correct. So the ordinary integral of a total derivative is always zero. And it's also true that the integral of a covariant derivative is zero if the square root minus g appears. One way of explaining why that's true is to say that this isn't something that's supposed to be obvious, but you can prove it from the expression for the Christoffel symbols in coordinates, is that the covariant divergence of a vector field is always equal to this. Always related to this expression that involves ordinary partial derivatives. And so if I were to plug it in, then the square root minus g's would cancel, and I'd be here in this first case where I'm just integrating an ordinary partial derivative. And this is also kind of a useful formula to know. Now, the implication of this being zero is that in general relativity, you can integrate by parts through the square root minus g, so to speak, if the derivatives are covariant. So for example, let me put some index structure here, but this would, you know, be true with different index structure. If I have this integral, then it's okay to integrate by parts and write it as x mu nu covariant derivative of y nu. And the reason that's okay, it looks weird. If this were an ordinary partial derivative, then you'd pick up an extra term when it acted on the square root minus g. Of course, the reason that's okay is that I can write the difference between the two, the left-hand side and the right-hand side, as a total derivative. This is with the square root minus g, is the covariant derivative of x b nu, y mu nu. This is just this ordinary proof that integration by parts works just with covariant derivatives. This first line is true by a formal property of the covariant derivative when it acts on a contraction of tensors. And then this first term is zero, as we just said. So that's how integration by parts works in GR. You can integrate by parts through the square root minus g, so to speak. Now here's an integration by parts that has something wrong with it. Maybe you can tell me what's wrong with it. I had this. Let's say I have something like this. Nothing about these examples really depends on the specific index structure here. I just put some in to illustrate. And then here, I decided to integrate by parts through the square root of minus g and get this. This is not right. Maybe someone can tell me what's wrong with this. This one is sort of subtle, but it really comes up. It really comes up in calculation.
It depends on why, right? Why is symmetric? This commutator of the derivative acting on x gives you some curvature, maybe.
Oh yeah, that's exactly right.
But if it's a commutator only, right? So.
why you use symmetric, then this should just be fine.
That is correct, actually, yeah. So you're right that I guess I didn't say whether Y was symmetric or not, and I was imagining that it would not have any specific properties like symmetry. But yeah, you've totally identified the reason that's wrong with it, the thing that's wrong with it. If I were to integrate by parts with the mu, I can put the mu over here. And that's fine, because this general argument works with any tensor, would allow me to integrate by parts with any tensor here, including a tensor which is the covariant derivative of something else. But that argument only works if applied to the outermost derivative. If I want to move an inner derivative over, then I need to first do a step where I commute the two. Then I can integrate by parts, and that picks up a curvature term. So if you work it through, you get some curvature term here, which I guess is going to be R, something like R mu. It's a minus sign. So sometimes when you integrate by parts in general relativity, you pick up these extra terms. It's sort of like sometimes you integrate by parts and get a boundary term. And that's usually making progress because the boundary term has one less dimension than the integral that you started with. And here you get another term, a curvature term, which might be making progress because it has two fewer derivatives than the thing you started with. Okay. What about this one? I'll put a question mark. I forgot the minus. That's exactly right. Yeah, this is okay because it was acting on covariant derivatives commute if applied to a scalar function. There's no room for a curvature term because there's no indices on F to contract with as there were here. In general, these derivatives just commute if applied to a scalar function, so there's no problem. That torsion-free property is one of the defining properties of the Liebig-Civita connection. Okay. Let's talk about inflation. All right, so you guys have seen inflation before, but I'm gonna sort of rehash it as a way of using this formalism we've built up. So inflation is a model which amazingly generates the right initial curvature perturbations. When I say inflation here, I'm always going to mean single field slow roll inflation. Where I just have a dynamical metric and a minimally coupled scalar field, meaning the kinetic term is just this guy, on a nearly flat potential. So the field content here is the 10 degrees of freedom of the metric plus phi. And When I talk about inflation, I often write things on with M Planck instead of G. V of phi is a flat potential. The technical flatness condition that will turn out to give the right initial perturbations is that both of these parameters are small, a quantity epsilon, which is v prime over v squared in Planck units, and a quantity eta, which is v double prime over v in Planck units. That's also much less than one. And these are called the slow roll parameters.
Is that what you mean by flat potential?
Yes. All right, so let's start by computing some equations of motion. So the phi equation of motion is obtained by just varying the action with respect to phi. When you do this, you'll find, I can write these derivatives as either covariant derivatives or partial derivatives. It doesn't matter when applied to a scalar function. If you write them as covariant derivatives, then normally when you vary a field in an action, if there's a term where that field appears with a derivative, then you integrate by parts to put the derivative, when you vary this so that delta phi appears, then you integrate by parts to put the covariant derivative on the other term. So it's important that, in general relativity, I can do that in integration by parts, that I can pull the derivative through the g mu nu and then around through the square root g to get this equation of motion. Just as the covariant Laplacian is equal to v prime, which is sort of what you would guess, the reason that's the right equation of motion is because of the way integration by parts works in GR. And then the stress energy tensor. To get the equation of motion for the metric, we'll compute the stress energy tensor and then use our general setup. We'll specialize Einstein's equations to the form of the stress energy tensor that we get. So the stress energy tensor here is T mu nu. By definition, the stress energy tensor is minus 2 over square root minus g times the derivative of the action with respect to g upper mu nu. Now, a formula in GR that kind of looks obscure but comes up all the time because we compute stress energy tensors. By the way, when we write the stress energy tensor is equal to this, what we mean is that we differentiate every term in the action except the Einstein-Hilbert term. So we don't differentiate this guy. And that's because varying this with respect to the action, gives the Einstein tensor r mu nu minus 1 half g mu nu r, with a 1 over 8 pi g. So that if we differentiate the rest of the action with respect to G and call that the stress energy tensor, then Einstein's equation will be the equation of motion, the total equation of motion for G. Okay, so we have to differentiate term by term with respect to the metric. So differentiating this G is easy, for example. That just brings in a derivative mu phi, derivative nu phi. But we also have to differentiate the square root of minus g sitting in front. And there's a formula in general relativity that looks obscure, but it comes up all the time when you compute stress energy tensors, is the formula that says that, and this is non-trivial to show, that the derivative of square root minus g with respect to g upper mu nu, square root of the determinant with respect to the inverse metric, is equal to minus 1/2 square root minus g mu nu, where this prefactor is just canceling the prefactor in the definition of the square root of the stress energy tensor. So the upshot at the end of the day is that you always have a term in the stress energy tensor where I differentiate this, where you differentiate the square root minus g, and just get a g mu nu in front. Times whatever's in the parentheses after the square root minus g in the action. So I get this.
So is that specifically true for a symmetric, or does it have to be a metric? Could it be any tensor?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure which. It's definitely true. It doesn't assume anything about the metric, so it's definitely true other than symmetry. Like, it doesn't assume anything about the derivatives of the metric or anything. So it is definitely true for an arbitrary symmetric tensor. In the anti-symmetric case, I'm not sure. Maybe these indices get switched or something.
Because in the proof, you use like this kind of e to the trace log something like this.
Oh, that's one way of deriving it. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it must be with an anti-symmetric tensor. It must be either like this or with the indices switched, but I'm not sure which way. Okay, so the first term in the metric tensor is just in the stress energy tensor is just g mu nu times everything in the action except for the r. That's what I get when I vary the square root minus g. And then there's a term that I get when I vary this g mu nu. So let me write that as, here I still have the square root minus g in front, and then I get I had a minus 1/2. So let me write that. I'll just leave it in that form. Well, I'll clean up a little. So far, I haven't really assumed anything. This stress energy and equation of motion would be true for a scalar field with an arbitrary potential minimally coupled to any metric. I haven't assumed that the metric is close to FRW or that the potential is slow roll. We want to specialize to the case where the metric is perturbed FRW. So let's first just start with the background solution. I.e. zeroth order in perturbation theory. So then phi is everything spatially homogeneous. So phi is just a function of t alone, sorry, phi bar. The metric tensor would look like this. This first term in front just gives the time derivative of phi squared in the 0, 0 position. This next term gives, so I have a g mu nu, which looks like this, times this square, which is only the rho equals 0 term contributes, but I raise this index, so I get a minus 1. So there's a minus phi dot squared here. And then the last term, v of phi times the metric, which is this. So if I put everything together, I get a t 0, 0, which is 1 half phi dot squared plus v, which is just the kinetic plus potential energy of the field. Pressure, which is 1 half phi dot squared minus v times delta ij. Now, we haven't put in perturbations yet, so this equation is just telling us that the FRW density of the background, that's whatever sits here, that's 1 half phi dot squared plus v, and the FRW pressure is whatever sits here in the stress energy tensor. That's 1 half phi dot squared minus v. So the equation of state, if I just had the first term, the equation of state would be 1. And if I just had the second term, the equation of state would be minus 1. So the way this works is that the kinetic energy, the part of the stress energy coming from the phi dot, is acting like a component with W equals 1. And the potential energy is acting like a component with W equals minus 1. It makes sense that it would act like a cosmological constant. If there's an overall constant in the action, it doesn't matter whether you say that constant is part of the lambda or part of the potential energy of some field. The flatness conditions that we wrote down, the smallness of the slow roll parameters, will turn out to ensure, we'll show shortly, will turn out to ensure that the potential energy dominates the kinetic energy. And the equation of state is close to minus 1. So that the space-time is close to de Sitter. That's the motivation for introducing this specific set of flatness conditions. They're what turn out to be necessary to make the expansion potential energy dominated. Tomorrow, every lecture, the amount that I cover is a lot less than I think I'm going to cover when I make the notes, but I think that's okay. All right, so the next lecture, I'll keep talking about inflation and talk about the behavior of the perturbations.